Welcome to the Listening Tide. Today we're recording not from the living room in Amsterdam Oostdorp, but from the kitchen at Current Plans in Hong Kong. That was Segundi Coro delle Lavandai, excuse my Italian. And our guest today is Eunice Tsang, who is founder of Current Plans here in Hong Kong and a curator at M Plus in Hong Kong. Eunice, welcome.
Hi, thank you so much.
Thank you for hosting.
Thank you. Thank you for being here and bringing all your gear over to Hong Kong.
It was happily packed into my suitcase. What did we just listen to? That was very rhythmic.
Yeah, I felt like I was in a trance a little bit. So I found this music through a party that I went to in Venice earlier this year in April. And it was in a warehouse organized by Nero Editions, a publisher that I really like in Italy. And apparently it's this guy called Mai. That's his musician name, who goes into southern Italy to record folk songs and turns these chants and music in with industrial and techno and electronic beats. So he was performing this piece. There was like four of these guys wearing weird, I don't know, paper mache masks, like animals with like capes, and they were just playing in this very, very small space with red lights, and I was just totally in a trance. It was like psychedelic. So it seems to be the second chorus of a chant that southern Italian women used to sing, or maybe they still sing. I'm not an expert on this, but I just feel so touched by this music.
For all you listeners there, we'll give you the teaser that we're going to end with the remix of the song this episode. But before we do that, we still have a lot of goodies in between. But just to go back to that space, you describe a very sort of carnivalesque setting. Is this part of what intrigued you in that?
That's true. I think so. I haven't thought of that part especially. That intrigued me, but I think now thinking back, the process of finding that party was also part of it. So it was the first time that I went to the Venice Biennale for the opening.
Yeah.
So of course there were many dinners and parties and all these things that you feel FOMO about.
Yeah.
But even before going, I was already very sure I wanted to go to this event organized by Nero, because they were just really cool people. And then after dinner, me and my friends tried to find this tiny place. It's a warehouse outside of the main area. And crossing through bridges at night and all that, and trying to find this place. It was like a bit of an adventure, of course. Also, Venice at night is another thing.
Sure.
And yeah, and then we just found this tiny place. It was packed full of people. And we just caught the tail end of this party. And this was just totally stunning. It was like maybe just 50 people packed into a small room with the red lights. And these guys were performing. And I think it's another kind of carnivalesque. So, of course, the Venice Biennale and all these things is a carnival in itself. The carnival also partly originating from Venice, which still is a tradition.
Yeah.
But this is the other kind of carnivalesque that I think I really enjoy most. Like very underground, very hidden, a little bit creepy.
Yeah. Do you consider that like also a state of exception, as carnival is often interpreted as, this sort of exceptional state? In many countries where it's celebrated, for example, the authority over a certain place is handed over to someone else for the period of the carnival and then offered back to authority. Is that something that it felt like?
Yeah, totally. And I have no idea what the space used to be or what it's like in the daytime. And I don't want to see it in the daytime, right? Like, I just want to memorize that. Yeah, I think that's partly why the carnivalesque is so interesting and also sometimes very problematic, right? I'm sure we'll delve into more of these later with the other recordings. Yes, and especially with that, what you mentioned, it's from the authorities, something said from the authorities where they take something that was supposed to suddenly transgressive from the masses, like this special day of... it's not usually only for celebration, right? There's something more sometimes sinister and naughty in it. This day of transgression, and then it became authorized by the church. Like you have this one set day where you can party,
you can let it out.
Let it out. You can cross dress, you can play king, you can play pretend to be the pope and all that, and then the next day everything goes back to normal. So it's like a pressure, what do you call it, a pressure valve? Valve where you just let steam off, release it, and then it all goes back to normal. So this is something that I'm really, really interested in like observing as well and taking part in, I suppose. That's why recently I'm also hosting a lot of parties.
Yeah.
Of course, it's also a way to engage like the community and stay together and all that. But with this space, with Current Plants, we started out with doing a lot of smaller parties in this old fabric storage we had 3 years ago.
The previous space.
The previous space. Mm-hmm. We recently moved to Spring Workshop. So, it was kind of a strange time because it was during COVID. We weren't really supposed to be hosting parties, so we did it very small scale. But luckily, we hadn't got into any trouble. Yeah. Like, there were once or twice that the police did come and check out what was happening.
Is that old school neighbors calling noise?
I suppose so, yeah. Mm. We were in a residential, very old residential walk-up sure. building. And, I mean, there were lots of people on the staircase smoking and all that.
Yeah.
So, yeah, the police
did
Hong Kong
need that at the time?
I definitely think so, yeah. We still need a lot of parties. I think a lot of party places, underground raves and all that, have been closed down the past few years.
Yeah.
Maybe in the past decade, all the party places that I used to go to have basically closed.
Yeah.
Due to rent issues, due to other issues, of course. So I think we definitely need that kind
that
of...
The pressure is building somewhere.
Exactly, exactly. Yeah, so it's also interesting to see how, because I work in a museum and institutions as well,
yeah.
how there seems to be more and more interest in hosting parties at museums also. And that's what I'm thinking about a lot recently as well. How do you host different kinds of parties or carnivals in different spaces with the same group of people, but they can mean very different things in different contexts?
And that's the space itself, of course. A place like M Plus, where you work, just as an example, brings with it an institutional side. It's a beautiful building, by the way, opened not that long ago. Mm-hmm. So it also it's has every opportunity to set a kind of personality for itself. Mm-hmm. Is there an awareness within yourself and perhaps in the larger institute of having that opportunity?
Yeah, definitely. You mean the personality of the
Of the institution, but also of the West Kowloon Cultural District?
Oh, the whole... Wow, yeah. This is another big thing. The West Kowloon District is this whole area that the government has been developing for culture and arts and all that.
Mm-hmm.
The museum is massive. It's beautiful. They've got amazing collections and amazing programs and amazing people working there. And yeah, recently they've been doing monthly parties as well.
Okay.
So there's some overlaps over with people that I collaborate with.
Yeah.
So it's an interesting time, like, because I'm working part-time there and then also working here in Current Plants, which I don't get paid for, by the way. Some people mistake that I'm having two jobs.
Yeah.
And I explain that it's like one and a half job. I really enjoy it for now. It's a bit schizophrenic, but I also like that feeling of having a balance between things that you can do and things you cannot do, and they kind of complement each other, I think.
Just to be clear, or not clear, but I'm curious to hear it. It's not so much the idea of for the sake of fun, or even only the sake of releasing that pressure, but there is perhaps a greater responsibility there in keeping a community together and creating a larger community from that.
Mm-hmm. Especially in having the chance to host or organize parties in a setting like a museum.
Yeah.
For me, I'm also thinking a lot about like how can we use the funding and the money to commission people doing interesting things that are underground but usually very ephemeral, or maybe they don't even want it to be too public, right? So what is the ethics and how can we make better use of these money, where maybe it's just once in a while a party at the museum, but that funding could already support maybe half a year of
any
programs
space.
In
the
space,
which
is how Current Plants partly started, actually, because we were commissioned by M Plus to do this Art Basel party, and then that budget was very helpful in sustaining Current Plants also.
Yeah.
So that's got me thinking, now that I'm part of this museum, how can I do the same and reciprocate to other smaller spaces, artisan spaces or initiatives?
I want to return to the drums, though, in this track, because it plays an important part, and played an important part in sort of creating this hypnotic trance that you describe, and enhancing this carnivalesque. But it also plays a little bit of a part in the next track that we are going to listen to.
Yeah.
And do you still want to say something about it in the first track, or would you like to sort of introduce a little bit what we're going to hear next?
I can do both at the same time.
I really like both, and I very much like the bridge between the two.
Nice. I'm glad. I was interested in this recording and also the next one that you'll hear, because they're both kind of ritualistic chants that have to do with a lot of spoken word. And sometimes those words might not necessarily be very logical. They're usually quite poetic or metaphorical.
Yeah.
And the beats are kind of a way to, when you have a chorus, a way to keep up together. And I was just really interested in that because also this artist who I first followed, like my, he is interested in what he calls the Mediterranean ontology.
Mm-hmm.
And this is exactly also what I've been thinking about in terms of Cantonese language and Hong Kong and all that. Because the next piece you'll hear is with Cantonese.
Yeah.
So just thinking about how to record these sounds and noises and poetry, how do you call it? Like everyday man, rural poetry.
Right.
And how do you transform that into something meaningful so that it's not just an archive, but it's more layered. It's even more layered, I think, with this transformation. So I think ontology and the carnivalesque and a little bit grotesque and a little bit of danger and naughtiness is kind of my stream of thought.
Right, that's
with
what
this,
the world needs a little bit more.
Right.
And we're going to hear a bit of these drums and chants and the interpretation of that, but represented by someone very familiar to you, your father.
Yeah, this one is my dad. So it's not done by him.
No.
But in Hong Kong, we have this really famous voodoo ritual.
Yeah.
It's called Da Xiu Yan, and it literally means hitting the small villain.
Yeah.
Small because if you call someone, oh, he's like a Xiu Yan, small person. He's like someone who's really bothersome, irksome, or like a douchebag, basically. Can I say that? Yeah.
Yeah, you can say that. Yeah. Sure. You can say whatever you like. Let's make it carnival.
Yeah, exactly. So this takes place in Wan Chai under a bridge called the Gooseneck Bridge.
Yeah.
And I think it's been around for decades. So there's, I think there's still maybe three or four aunties remaining there. They have these small huts and there's paper offerings. Some of them drawn in the shape of a person, sometimes in a tiger. There's like different meanings for each of them. And what you do is you go and pay this auntie to do this ritual to someone that you really hate. It can be your boss. It can be your ex-lover or a competitor or whatever. Yeah. And she'll do this Da Xiu Yan ritual for you. So this happened a few years ago during a very interesting time in Hong Kong. And my dad, who is normally a very, very like logical guy, he's a family doctor.
Yeah.
Scientific
guy. Yeah.
And we've never even talked about things like spirituality or God or like all these things. We were like very, very atheist.
Mm-hmm.
So one day my mom just sent over this recording and she was like, oh, look what your dad did today. And I just really laughed out loud. It was just so out of expectation for me on his personality. So I really, really treasure this small recording.
You're born and raised in Hong Kong. You'd never been there with your parents. You didn't know there was any interest. So out of the blue came this recording.
Yeah, so he must have been really, really frustrated with this villain. Yeah.
Okay, I'm going to play it and then maybe we speak just a little bit more about it.
Thank you.
It's great. The recording ends when the payment is made.
And I just realized only at the end, like, you just, what do you call it? Faded out,
yeah,
when the lady was like, okay, let me give you my business card. I didn't even notice that.
I went to this underpass. Underpass. So I'm greatly impressed and very appreciative that you brought it in. If I may say, to someone who's never been in Hong Kong and maybe listening right now, it's an incredibly intense and rather chaotic place in a way. I went on a Sunday, so also there were a lot of domestic workers, mainly from Indonesia, proudly wearing also Indonesian flags and Indonesian, the colors of the Indonesian flag. Picnicking and seeing each other, sharing meals, talking, I'm sure. And then indeed these women in the middle, we hear the noise of the crossing signals. We hear drums, which I'd like to ask you about in just a moment. But what I wanted to ask you, for those who haven't seen the film, because you're only listening to it now, but it is nice to kind of say what takes place. There is a candle. Candles being lit by your father. The drawing of a figure is being given to this woman. She slaps this drawing to pieces. Then there is a kind of gold piece of paper that she takes out and sort of fans around your father, sort of around his aura in a way, not touching him, but around it. She then lights this flame. While the flame is lit, that also goes around a little bit like a halo around him. And then with another piece of paper, she's touching his hands. She asks him to open his hands and to hit these. And all the while, your father is saying things sometimes to her. So
he's way too talkative. Yeah, he's like commenting on it, and my mom is scoffing.
Oh, yeah? Okay, so he's just sort of making general commentary.
Yeah, just explaining how much he hates this person.
Oh.
It's a person in government, anyway.
Oh, he's explaining it all the while.
Yeah.
Okay, and he used one of the drawings there as the image of that person.
Right. Exactly. Because actually, I haven't done this before, but I pass by it all the time, and it's so famous in Hong Kong. But it's not something that I usually do, and I don't have someone that I hate so much that I felt the need to do it. So, yeah, apparently you're not actually even supposed to say the name of the person, but my dad says it right in the video, which is quite funny. So, yes, so the funny, it's kind of funny because it's very vernacular, very rural kind of tradition that started out in Canton. So also they're like sitting on these tiny plastic stools, right? You saw that. So they're like kind of squatting and hunched over this tiny piece of paper, and she hits it with like a slippers, I think. Which is also very Asian imagery, like this auntie with the slippers.
Yeah,
and I just found it fascinating with this video, with my dad doing it, and also the background sounds that you mentioned.
Yeah.
So you hear the traffic lights because there's a market nearby, the food market, wet market, and then there's a fire station. And this was a few years back, so also the streets were like full of people. I mean, it still is now.
Yeah.
But I mean, even where the cars are, it was like full of people at that time.
Yeah.
And you hear the drums. So the drums are not usually there, but it was just because of this time that they were drumming. But just so happens, it kind of relates to the first recording that we heard, I think. So there's something very like universal and humane about drumming, I suppose.
Yeah, these drums, less for that exceptional carnivalesque state and more for a call to a certain direction. If
absolutely.
I understand, I don't know. Is that correct? Because of these years back.
Yeah, absolutely. And like slogans, Yeah, no, I think that's right. Like, it's like call to arms, call to join together.
Yeah, interesting.
And then also, of course, like her slapping the paper thing also becomes a kind of like drumming as well, like the violence on this very fragile little piece of paper.
Yeah.
So there's some kind of like dark comedy in it. I feel like there's something massive happening in the background, and then there's this microcosm of this paper thing, you know, flailing around.
Do you take a step back in that sense to these kind of traditions in a way, with every respect, perhaps? But do you see it from that sort of relative distance when your parents send you a video like this, and you think of how it plays a role in your surroundings?
It's interesting because I grew up without a lot of no spirituality or like Christian beliefs or anything. I went to Catholic school, so that was more forced on me. I was always running away from it. But yeah, there's so many Cantonese Chinese rituals and beliefs that my friends talk about, or they go to see, like tarot or feng shui, these kind of things. I've never touched it, but the more I grow up, the more I hear about it and see my friends into it, the more curious I feel about. And I think this always happens, right? It's also quite universal. Like, the more upset you are with like certain structures set in place by the government, by the system, the more people will turn into like the magical thinking, like folkloric traditions. They're tradition, and they are still surviving for some reason, I feel. So it's almost a kind of, I think it's magical thinking, basically, like manifestation and magical thinking. Like, even my dad, who is like this doctor, scientific guy, felt the need, the urge to go there.
This overwon his rationality.
And you can kind of hear my mom a bit scoffing and like giggling behind, because even she feels it's a bit ridiculous. Just love it.
So we were looking for a track to play next. It was difficult to find, so we came up with a different solution. For the first time in the Listening Tide, somebody's going to read something out loud.
Cringe. Very cringe. Yeah, so the reason why I wanted to go into this piece was because when we were talking about this, I wanted to bring in something that's Cantonese, because Cantonese is also a language that's slowly approaching danger, because China wants us to use Mandarin as the main language, the mother tongue for Hong Kong, right? So this, I think there's a great need to preserve Cantonese in all forms. And actually, Cantonese was one of the earliest written language also used in China. And it's only recent decades that Mandarin has taken over and simplified Chinese. We have traditional and simplified Chinese. That it's taken over as like this universal Chinese language. So that's why I was really trying to insist on something Cantonese, Chinese, right. Hong Kong. So this is very cringe that I have to read this out. So maybe I can explain a little bit. Before opening Current Plans, this space, in 2019, I worked at RTHK, so Radio Television Hong Kong, which is a TV and radio, a broadcast station. It's been around for decades. It's kind of like the maybe BBC version of Hong Kong, where all it's like public channel, right? So I was working there as a TV producer, and we did a lot of art, cultural, musical documentaries, very short documentaries covering people coming in to perform, or new exhibitions or studio visits and so on. It's quite a formal TV show, let's say. It's just for the public. But I joined during a time when I just felt so disillusioned from working in institutions. I was working at another place before, that I just really wanted to step out. I know I can only do arts and culture by process of elimination. I don't have any other skills. So I thought, why not jump back into journalism? So someone introduced me, and it was like the best year of my life, because I was just basically interviewing my own friends who had new shows, and I knew I was being helpful because I was helping them promote their shows and telling their stories. And I think ultimately that's all we're trying to do, right? Like telling stories. And that's what interests me in art, even art making.
Telling those stories.
Exactly. So this was an interesting story that I found that was about video games. So during my stint working there, I tried to introduce a few stories that were about video games and their intersections with art and contemporary art. So I was really interested in the Uncensored Library. I don't know if you've heard of this.
No.
It's Minecraft,
sure.
The game.
Sure.
So I think it's a British collective. They built this massive, massive open world game called the Uncensored Library. Anyone can go in for free.
Yeah.
And they built this massive palace space, and that's like a library. But inside there are actual books and in different wings of real censored books from different countries, from Egypt, from China and all these places. And you can go in and read these books. So this is through a video game.
Yeah.
And I was just blown away. So we did this story. And every time we do a story, I usually do it in English because it's on the English channel.
Yeah.
But then they also reproduce the same story. We have to do our own voiceover and record it in Cantonese, basically. And
for the Cantonese audience.
Yeah, for the Cantonese audience. Yeah. So basically the same. So we always had to write the scripts, like I have it open here, and then our colleague would translate into Chinese and then send it back to us, and then we would have to go in the recording studio.
Yeah.
To record with our own voice. I don't know why I had to do it myself. I wish someone professional could do it for me.
If I can just be, yeah. Just so that I understand, mm-hmm. it's first done
in English.
In English?
Yeah.
And then it's done in...
Yeah, in Cantonese.
Okay,
yeah.
Okay.
So there are exact two same programs, but yeah. one in English and one in Cantonese,
yeah.
broadcast at different times for different audiences. So in Hong Kong, we do speak Cantonese mostly, but yeah. also Mandarin.
Yeah. And this is at a time when you worked there, by the way, that pressure, mm-hmm. that cloud was not hanging over the Cantonese language as much as it is
oh,
now.
Oh, correct. Yeah, yeah.
It was at all? Or
I think it was slowly approaching.
Okay.
There have been times already, but it was still a very Hong Kong focus channel. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's still, is it? Wait, no, I take that back. It still kind of is.
Yeah.
But yeah, the cloud was not really over our head yet. Yeah. So that's why.
Okay. You want to go for it? Okay, you ready? You feel all right?
Not look at me.
We have sitting next to Eunice, just for our listeners, and he will be our guest in another episode here at Current Plans. the artist who is now also showing here, Sing Yan Se Se.
Exactly.
And he's laughing. Or he's smiling. I shouldn't say he's not laughing. He's smiling.
So should I just read the...
Yeah, is there any kind of like introduction sound you'd like?
Oh, I don't know. Some video game sounds. I don't know. Minecraft sounds. Okay. Let me try. Okay. Dong yin sat ge. Oh, I already said it wrong. Dong yin sat sai gai ge mantai mo ban fa gai ku ge si ho. Yodian, we da ge. Bo fun yan. Ying wai yao hei hai to be yin sat ge fong fa. Ling yat di zhou ying wai. Ho yi tau go yao hei. Tam zhao gai ku fong fa. 虛擬世界無限制，而且相對地不受地理和政治因素的規限。最近呢，無國界記者德國的辦事處呢，就示範怎樣透過一個創意的電腦遊戲繞過媒體審查法例。So bad. It's very cringe because I have to try to really verbalize each word, which I
this
don't
is really,
really
BBC
do.
Cantonese. What I just heard.
It's really bad. It's like ABC.
I'm looking at Sing now. Sing, is this BBC Cantonese? Okay.
Oh, every time my show is being broadcast, and sometimes friends just turn on the TV, like when they're having dinner at home with the family, and yeah. then they hear the Chinese version. I always receive texts saying that, "Is that you? You sound so cringe." Because what happens is like most of the journalists, because I was working part time actually, so yeah. most of the journalists there, apart from doing these productions and investigations and write up, they also go through classes where they have to learn how to speak Cantonese properly, like very properly.
Yeah.
So there are some sounds that are kind of different from the vernacular Cantonese.
Yeah.
So it's as if it's not complicated enough already with the nine tones. So I never went through that training, right? Because I was just a part-time person. So they never gave me that training. So when I had to do that, like there would be another colleague, like an older colleague, who would kindly like support me and sitting next to me, try to... train me.
Yeah.
But I just, even though it's so cringe, I just really wanted to bring this up because of this.
No, I can understand it. And I'm wondering, so you mentioned that there is a certain kind of authority also in how to speak that Cantonese correctly.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
So how does that authority relate to what we're speaking about, that the Cantonese language itself is under threat? Is that a force to be reckoned with? Or is that does that push back, if I could ask?
Yeah.
Or does that resign itself to these changes that
I think there's a lot of pushback. So it hasn't happened yet where we're only having Mandarin schools or, you know, Mandarin whatever. Yeah, I mean, journalists, government still speak Cantonese, right? And we always still make fun of a lot of government officials who cannot even speak Mandarin properly. So there is still this big divide, actually, through the language. So I don't think anytime soon Cantonese will be taken over because it's such a deep-rooted language.
No.
That's why.
And is there already an interwovenness between the two, Mandarin and Cantonese? Is there like a dialect or a slang that is both of those together in Hong Kong?
Both of those together.
Would you find people who maybe persons who are even younger, you know, between 10 and 20 now or something like this? Who speak a mix of both somehow as one language, so it's not switching off to this and then switching back, or having a group of friends that speak Cantonese and then another, but actually the language has become sort of a mix between one, like
what
would happen on an island. I mean, you know, this is an island and consisting of many islands.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I personally don't really know any friends who speak a merging of both, but definitely with friends, sometimes we use the Mandarin slang, Cantonese slang together and all that.
Yeah.
And it's also interesting because there seems to be this binary divide between like Mandarin or English and then Cantonese in between, just because I grew up with Cantonese. But for example, my parents who grew up in Hong Kong under the British colonial rule, they actually speak English much better than Mandarin. So they actually cannot really communicate if they travel in China or Taiwan.
Oh, wow.
They cannot really speak Mandarin. But their grammar is perfect. It's like impeccable. Yeah, so I find that
fascinating.
Yeah, and then at the same time, my grandparents were the ones who swam over from China, right, to escape the revolution, and of course they used to speak Mandarin, and so there's this very strange.
So they didn't pass it on to their children,
right, because they had to escape, right? That's why they came to Hong Kong.
They had to break
Kong.
Ties.
Yeah, and at that time Hong Kong was already under Britain's rule.
And you learned Mandarin at school?
I learned Mandarin at school.
So you speak better Mandarin than your parents?
Yeah, not the best, but better than them. Yeah.
How fascinating. So your grandparents spoke Mandarin, they broke, your parents don't really, and you again do.
Yeah.
And it's possible that if and when your children
could
be speaking more Mandarin and their Cantonese could be weaker.
Yeah.
I noticed actually, now that we just mentioned it, on the streets, just listening, unfortunately, I have no capacity to understand a lot of the language around me. But I do see a lot of persons speaking English with and towards their children. As a first language. So these are young children, and the conversations are being had in English. And then between the partners, the parents themselves, they're speaking what sounds to me then to be either Cantonese or Mandarin. I wouldn't know this, but...
Yeah.
And I'm wondering if that's maybe because they're preparing their children as a generation for... an international sort of advantage.
Exactly. I think either they're in international school or they're preparing them, sending them abroad, you know, to study abroad. So definitely, yeah, this is a very Hong Kong thing, I feel. Yeah.
Are we going to see you abroad soon?
I hope so.
That'd be really nice.
Yeah. I think so. I cannot stay in one place for too long.
Great.
Hong Kong feels claustrophobic after a while, even though I love it to death.
Before we end today, I just want to say I'm very happy that you stayed in the seat for for this hour of the listening
already?
Tide. Okay. Yeah, it is actually. Thank you very much for your time.
No, thank you. Thank
Eunice,
you.
We're going to end with maybe you want to send us off?
Yes. So this is, can I redo the Italian name that you just
No, please. Then we both had a go at it and see who's the closest.
Secondo coro delle lavandaie. Bye, my.